Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for all listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. On this episode and the next, I'm taking a look at my first cold case for the show. Well, cold in that it's unresolved, but most people connected to the case don't necessarily consider it unsolved. It's about the murders of two young sex workers in a very small town with a history of corruption that is astounding. I'm also surprised it isn't a more famous case. It was featured on Unsolved Mysteries back in the day, but then lay dormant for more than 20 years. When I say it isn't famous, maybe I should clarify that it's not a popular case in the true crime community. It was, however, pretty infamous at the time with its own small town Heidi Fleiss, crooked cops, and a full cast of sloppy and/or corrupt city leaders. Aside from our beloved Unsolved Mysteries, it was featured in the Washington Post, the LA Times, among a lot of other major outlets. Paul Harvey did a segment on it, and it was even a punchline for Jay Leno. Basically, it was covered like a hillbilly soap opera, and reading back on the articles at the time of the murders, you can practically taste the contempt. But finally, in September of 2013, three men were charged with the murders. They went to court in September of 2016 and were acquitted. Suddenly, it wasn't so funny anymore. This is the case known as the Kentucky Bordello Murders. Two young women were found in the back of a seedy massage parlor, nude, throat slashed, and shot execution style. The massage parlor was just a front for prostitution. Gloria Ross and Candace Belt were found brutally murdered in a brothel that shared space with a Chinese restaurant in the small town of Oak Grove, Kentucky. With a population of 3,000 at the time, Oak Grove sits adjacent to the Fort Campbell military base on the border of Kentucky and Tennessee. But there's not much more background you'll find when trying to research the lives of Gloria and Candy. They were relegated to being salacious background props in a larger-scale drama that unfolded in their town. And especially once the case went cold, their lives were forgotten. Their murders were an ugly blight on the community, and legendary only because of who was long suspected of the crime for the more than 20 years before legal action was taken. But they were also human beings, 18 and 22 years old, both young mothers in hard situations, and as twisty and unbelievable, and yes, fascinatingly scandalous as this case is, it's also tragic and infuriating on so many levels. I usually try to give a little bit of history about the town and the cases I cover. In this one, I'm going to need to cover the county and larger towns around it as well for you to get the whole picture. Hopkinsville, Kentucky was initially claimed in 1796 by Bartholomew Wood as part of a 1,200-acre grant for his service in the American Revolution. Following the creation of Christian County in the same year, the Woods family donated 5 acres of land and half their interest in Old Rock Spring to form the county's seat of government in 1797. The Kentucky Assembly established the town in 1804 as Hopkinsville after veteran and state representative Samuel Hopkins, another Revolutionary War hero. Hopkinsville was a stop along the Trail of Tears, and a park along 9th Street on the Little River memorializes this shameful history. There is a museum and burial ground, with several large Osage orange trees in it and dream catchers hanging from the wrought iron fencing. Hopkinsville has strong agricultural roots dating back to the settlements in the 1790s. It has been a strong and consistent leader in the production of corn, winter wheat, soybeans, and especially tobacco. Today, Hopkinsville has a population of a little over 32,000 people and is predominantly white. With 67% of the population white and only about 28% African American. Racial tensions especially permeated the city in the later decades of the 20th century, and in the 1990s, when the murders took place, Hopkinsville notoriously refused to name a street after the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Hopkinsville serves as the county seat of Christian County, and the Civil War created major divisions across the county and state as Confederate support was strong with the formation of the Oak Grove Rangers and the 28th Kentucky Cavalry. Christian County was also the birthplace of Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, in the tiny town of Fairview with a population of less than 300 people. Several local businessmen and plantation owners contributed money and war supplies to the South. But after Confederate forces retreated to Tennessee, Camp Joe Anderson was established by the Union to the northwest of Hopkinsville in 1862. Named for Colonel William Christian, another Revolutionary War hero, Christian County is the second largest county in Kentucky. On the whole, the county has always thought pretty highly of itself and its piety. As one journalist put it, if Christian County were an island, it would sink beneath the weight of its Baptist churches. It has a population of just over 70,000, the demographics of which are unusual, with a higher percentage of racial minorities than any other county in Kentucky, despite the disparity of the ratios in Hopkinsville. However, it is still intensely segregated. Before the Civil War, about half of the population was enslaved, and unfortunately, the social hierarchy never really changed. Most of the local officials are white, and nearly all of the police force in the Christian County Sheriff's Department are white. 15% of residents are below the poverty level, but even the median income of just over $32,000 per year is lower than the national standard, which is nearly twice that at $57,000 per year. Christian County is also the home of Fort Campbell, in the tiny adjacent military town of Oak Grove, where our story takes place. Right next door to Oak Grove, on the other side of Fort Campbell, lies Clarksville, Tennessee. Clarksville's roots also go back to the Revolutionary War. It was designated as a town to be settled by soldiers from the Continental Army that served under General George Washington. At the end of the war, the federal government lacked sufficient funds to repay the soldiers. So the legislature of North Carolina, in 1790, designated the lands to the west of the state to be used in the land grant program. The development and culture of Clarksville has a long history of intermingling its citizens with the military. Aside from the formation of the city being associated with the end of the American Revolutionary War, during the Civil War, a large percent of the male population was depleted due to Union Army victories at Fort Henry and Fort Donelson. Clarksville also lost many men during World War I. With the formation of Camp Campbell, later known as Fort Campbell, during World War II, the bonds of military influence were strengthened, and the male population once again surged. Fort Campbell, which sits on over 100,000 acres, comprising more than 160 square miles, or 257 kilometers, is situated between Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and Clarksville, Tennessee. It was constructed at the beginning of World War II when the Army decided it needed a training camp in the South to help support the influx of troops after the draft. It is 7 times the physical size of Manhattan, if that gives you a better idea of scale. With its own golf course, bowling alley, and Starbucks, the base is a small city unto itself. It is home to 3 major combat units. The 5th Special Forces Group, which was among the first deployed and the last to leave Vietnam, the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, made famous in the movie Black Hawk Down, and of course, the world-famous Screaming Eagles, the 101st Airborne Division, renowned for its service in World War II, Vietnam, and just about every major conflict the U.S. has been involved in. Soldiers at Fort Campbell, Kentucky have deployed in every single U.S. military campaign since the formation of the post. Over 30,000 soldiers reside on the base, with officers owning nice homes in Hopkinsville and Clarksville, but the small town of Oak Grove, Kentucky is and was the real hive for young enlistees. The little city is located literally outside of the military's gates, and in the early 1990s, it had a population of around 3,000, give or take, depending on deployments. Fort Campbell at the time housed about 24,000 soldiers, their dependents, and about 4,000 civilian employees. The Army's presence should have ignited rapid economic development in Hopkinsville, right on the border of the base, as well as being the county seat of Christian County, if the city had extended its borders down to the state line. It was basically empty farmland for the taking, ripe for business leaders to build new neighborhoods in a commercial district, which is what happened on the other side of the post in Clarksville. But Hopkinsville and Christian County in general did not want to be associated with the base, at the time considering the soldiers to be an inferior social class. Basically, they didn't want the soldiers mingling in their social circles, much less consorting with their daughters, not that it stopped them. And the soldiers found themselves often the target of both the city and county police forces. In 1952, the Army threatened to make the city off-limits for all soldiers after a federal grand jury found that the Hopkinsville Police Department did have a tradition of police brutality against their soldiers. Tensions lasted up through the 1970s when the Army swelled again due to the draft being reinstated for the Vietnam War. Fort Campbell couldn't handle the sudden growth, and the local housing demand started booming. But instead of a sleepy suburb of the base, what popped up almost overnight were more trailers and clapboard housing owned by just a handful of rich families. And along with it, a burgeoning strip of pawn shops, liquor stores, and strip clubs that ensured that the rich kept getting richer and the soldiers and locals stayed trapped in the poverty-stricken social cycle. By 1974, the soldiers who were a runoff from the overcrowded base were deemed an unruly nuisance for the very business owners that depended on them. So, in order to create a police force, these businesses partnered up to incorporate the city of Oak Grove. It was 1 square mile, and town leaders valiantly tried to brand it the hometown of Fort Campbell. That nickname did not stick, nor did it even come close to how Oak Grove was viewed by Hopkinsville, Clarksville, and especially Christian County in general. Oak Grove was definitely the trashy cousin the rest of the family was ashamed of. Basically, the town that was begun by real estate partners was now being run by one powerful family in particular, the Elliots. They owned several trailer parks, and two brothers, Mayor Jack Elliott and Chief of Police Buddy Elliott, ran that town for more than a decade. Buddy Elliott even served as a city judge for several years in the 70s, often presiding over the legal proceedings for citizens he'd arrested himself in the first place. It was well known around town that Buddy helped fund the new city government with a speed trap that quickly racked up fines, and of course, as judge, those tickets were rarely dismissed if they were even actually challenged. There was also a rumor from former city employees that Buddy Elliott would send out his patrol officers to serve stop work orders on his competitors' building projects. The Elliott family's corruption was an open secret for 2 decades. And on their watch, Oak Grove grew a reputation that it would never shake. Mainly that its police force was feared for its brutality to soldiers. 2 different lawsuits with several different plaintiffs happened in the early 80s, accusing Oak Grove police of beating and tasing soldiers without provocation. All of these incidents were separate, but the soldiers banded together to strengthen their cases. And it wasn't just the soldiers. Residents on both sides of the state line came to think of Oak Grove as dangerous and a place to drive around, not through. But the other part of the problem was Buddy's habit of leaning on local business owners to finance things his department needed, either in exchange for supposed protection, or his officers used outright intimidation. Now is a good time to introduce a woman named Tammy Papler. A woman who would one day blow this whole operation out of the water. Tammy Papler was the owner of New Life Fitness and Massage and an adult video store called Cherry Video. New Life was actually a front for Tammy's real business. She was the madam of a very lucrative brothel. She herself was a former sex worker, going by the name Mercedes. She had worked in Nashville, moving to Oak Grove in 1989 after quitting and getting married, and set up her business with the help and encouragement of her new husband, Ronnie. She had a lot of competition. Along with New Life, there were lots of places to go for adult entertainment in Oak Grove. Tipper's Dance Club, Mona's Go-Go, Classic Touch, Cat West, Fantasy Lingerie, and Donna's Den all offered above-the-board legal services, and were said to also dabble below the law into prostitution as well. But these places weren't organized to promote sex work the way Tammy's place was. She was a pro, and not just in the colloquial sense of the word either. She really ran a tight ship. She kept detailed records, enforced strict rules on the workers, particularly the use of condoms, and was known to have a hot temper to those that defied her. The various sexual services offered were priced from $45 to $125, and the Papplers kept half of what the girls made. Some customers paid in cash, others by credit card, but all of them had to provide a driver's license and sign a form stating that they were not paying for sex before they chose the woman they wanted. They were then shown to a private room where the worker would undress and then give them a condom, which, according to Tammy, was a strict requirement and not up for negotiation. 26 years old, with fluffy bleach blonde hair set with a perm, Tammy Papler was as attractive a woman as she was professional. But first and foremost, she was a shrewd businesswoman and chose the location for New Life carefully. It was located literally outside the northern gate of Fort Campbell next to I-24, ensuring a steady stream of soldiers, truckers, and of course, town locals. It was rumored that doctors, lawyers, and even judges came from Nashville, Clarksville, and Hopkinsville to patronize her business discreetly. What we do know for sure is that the police force in Oak Grove were most definitely regulars. But just because local cops were known to frequent her establishment didn't mean that she was guaranteed a pass from prosecution. In fact, she was a target for extortion. In 1993, a few New Life workers were charged with prostitution, and Buddy Elliott himself paid a call to Tammy and point-blank asked her if she planned to get with the program. She handed him $600 in cash right then and there. When the case reached the grand jury, the charges were dropped, but Tammy's cooperation had pretty much sealed her fate with local law enforcement. For the next year, the local cops became a regular presence at New Life, and they took full advantage of their power in the situation, often insisting on sex for free. Like I said before, Tammy kept detailed records, and in instances when the police refused to pay, they were noted at the bottom of her daily ledger, along with the girl they had been with, so that Tammy could pay the worker herself later. Tammy Papler might have been a lot of things, a pimp not the least among them, but no one could say she cheated her workers or expected them to work for free. Despite the exploitative nature of her business, she made sure the girls were paid, made sure they were safe, and was said to have always kept her word. But once you pay the chief of police to stay in business, he's pretty much on your payroll. I've noted before how the town didn't generate much tax revenue, and along with Buddy's speed traps, they were always looking for ways to supplement the budget. Every time a police car needed new lights or the station house needed work, they looked to Tammy to foot the bill. And she put up with it. I'm sure she felt she had little choice. And one cop in particular started hanging around New Life more than the others. Ed Carter, already a fixture at the establishment, began a relationship with the manager, and then bullied Tammy into putting him on the payroll. Officially, his checks noted payment for janitorial services, but Tammy would later confirm that he never so much as touched a mop. She knew this was hush money, but didn't know how to get out of it. Because despite being tight with Buddy Elliott himself, she was still in constant danger of being shut down. She also had deals with a couple of dispatchers at Oak Grove and around Christian County, who would give her discreet heads up when she was about to be raided. She'd get a call telling her a storm was coming, or that it was time to get the umbrellas out. Then the New Life girls would get dressed and patiently wait for the cops to search the place and move on. Among the girls that worked for Tammy were two close friends named Gloria Ross and Candy Belt. Both were young mothers. Gloria was 18 years old and Candy was 22. Gloria had a husband, Ryan Ross, who was a soldier at Fort Campbell. The couple had two young children and were hard-pressed for money. Ryan helped Gloria get a job at a strip club to help with the bills, and then helped her get the job at New Life Massage in September of 1994. He was under no illusions about his wife's work there. Their youngest child was only 6 weeks old, and Gloria was still breastfeeding at the time. I understand that times were hard, and we'll get into Ryan a bit more in part two, but it's difficult to reckon with a man pressuring his wife into sex work right after a new baby. Candace Belt was also a young mother at 22 and was single, just barely scraping by while trying her best to raise her two kids. I suppose her choice is a little more understandable, more common, though just as heartbreaking. Her ex-husband had also been a soldier, but after their second child was born, he deserted her. The loneliness and fear she must have felt trying to take care of herself and two children must have been agonizing as she accepted the job at New Life. Personally, I consider both of them more than just desperate victims of poverty. They were used by the men in their lives and then exploited by Tammy Papler. I will talk more about Tammy Papler's role in this whole saga in the next episode, but suffice it to say that regardless of her later actions, I don't think much of her or her husband. But back to our timeline. Tammy and her husband Ronnie took a vacation over Labor Day weekend to New York City. They decided to cut their trip short and come home early, immediately stopping by New Life to check on business. To their surprise, they found the police officer Ed Carter at the front desk. He had cash laid out and was going through the day's payment slips. Tammy was furious and kicked him out, later saying, "It was like he was the madam. I wasn't the madam anymore. It was actually like he was. I was furious with him. I didn't want him around my business anymore. I didn't want him around the girls. We had a meeting, and I informed each and every one of them of this. You do not allow him around here anymore. It's the end of it." This was her recollection when interviewed for Unsolved Mysteries. She later testified to the same facts in court, but she equivocated that short of changing the locks, there wasn't much she could do about it. Part of me asks, why didn't she just change the damn locks? But I guess in reality, she was right. He was a cop. He was keeping her secret. He had already shown a propensity to abuse this authority with the New Life workers, though none of them had ever actually accused him of physical abuse. He just expected to have his choice of women and then refused to pay. And of course, he had insisted on being put on the payroll. Tammy may not have bothered with changing the locks, but she damn sure stopped paying Ed Carter immediately. For the next 2 weeks, there were no janitorial services paid for to Ed Carter or his wife, who he later claimed actually did clean for Tammy Papler. Over the next 2 weeks, Ed Carter did make appearances at New Life. Tammy and the workers later couldn't recall exactly how much he was around, but it's safe to say Tammy was not successful in running him off. On September 20th, she and her husband Ronnie had gone to a movie. It was a slow night at work for the girls. A worker named Tammy Sneed was on duty. She was 24 years old and had also been married to a Fort Campbell soldier and started working at New Life shortly after her divorce. Along with Gloria and Candy, there were two other women working that night, Millie Burns and Andrea Fornella. Tammy Sneed recalled that the women were hanging out in the lobby drinking and talking. She said with no customers and, of course, no boss in the house, it kind of felt like a girls' night. Millie Burns agreed, saying that they were bonding, though they did all agree later that Gloria and Candy tended to stay to themselves. They were close friends, and also both fairly new, so that's understandable. But at any rate, the girls were enjoying the slow night at work and were all chatting amiably. At 2 a.m., Sneed and Burns later testified, Ed Carter showed up. He walked right in the front door as usual and then picked up the lobby phone. They say he punched in some numbers but didn't actually make a call. They thought it was odd, and they definitely knew he wasn't supposed to be there, but they didn't want to say anything. Who could blame them? For all her official meetings with the workers, I'm not sure Tammy Papler actually expected them to throw Carter out. And he never said anything to the girls either, and left shortly after walking in. An hour later, Tammy Sneed and Millie Burns left to take Andrea Fornella home, leaving Gloria and Candy alone. New Life was still empty of customers, and there was no point in them all staying until 5 a.m. Sneed and Burns later testified that they returned to New Life at 3:35 a.m., and the front door wouldn't open. They tried knocking on the door and the window, but they didn't get an answer. Then they tried the door again and realized it wasn't locked. There was a heavy rock that was usually used as a doorstop blocking the door from the inside. They pushed harder and made their way inside. In the lobby, they noticed an overturned ashtray and saw that the phone was off the hook. Still unconcerned, they both later said they assumed Gloria and Candy were cleaning. The place was deathly silent, though, and all of a sudden, Tammy Sneed heard what she thought was someone snoring. She and Millie then thought that maybe the girls were napping, but kept checking all the rooms anyway. Every room was empty, until they made it to the end of the hall in what was called the jungle room. Only one small light was on, illuminating the massage table. On the table was Gloria Ross. She was nude, with her hands crossed over her chest, and was covered in blood. Her eyes were open, her throat was slashed, and there was a bullet hole in her head pouring blood onto the floor. On the floor, close to the massage table, they found Candy Belt, nude but covered in a camouflage blanket, which Tammy Sneed and Millie soon realized was faintly moving up and down with her breathing. She was still alive. And the snoring sound Tammy had heard was actually a gurgling in Candy's throat as she tried to breathe through blood. Her throat had also been slashed, and she'd also been shot in the head. One eye pitifully bulged from its socket. Tammy Sneed and Millie Burns then ran screaming from the building. It's hard to blame them. Having walked into that scene with blood still dripping, they were afraid the killer was still inside. They ran directly across the street, right up to the gates of Fort Campbell. The soldier on duty told them that they couldn't just walk in, but Tammy Sneed, who was at this point hysterical, screamed that he had to let them through and that someone was dying. He let them in, where they went to the military police station and called the Oak Grove police and paramedics. There were two Oak Grove patrolmen on duty that time of night, Bobby Combs and William Sparks. They arrived at New Life around 4 a.m., coming from opposite directions. They did a quick check of the building, making sure the killer wasn't still inside, and then checked both women's pulses, finding that Candy Belt was miraculously still alive. When the paramedics arrived, they helped get her into the ambulance and then radioed Leslie Duncan, the only detective in the Oak Grove Police Department. Les Duncan took immediate command of the scene, but was exhausted having just come from another murder scene at a trailer park. He called in the Christian County Sheriff's Department. Within a half hour, the entire Oak Grove police force, Tammy Papler and her husband, the mayor, several city council members, and even a nearby strip club manager who listened to a police scanner, were all on the scene, and every single one of them was allowed past the crime scene tape. Witnesses later said at least 30 or more people trampled through the small building and parking lot that night. By the time the Christian County Sheriff's deputies arrived, it was obvious the crime scene was contaminated, and they vehemently did not want to get involved. But after a call to the state police, who were equally unhelpful and refused to get involved, they had to stay on scene and with the investigation. The county's ambivalence right out of the gate is understandable given the state of the crime scene, but also I think it explains a lot of what happened later. Sometime after 5 a.m., Ed Carter showed up at the crime scene with his police dog on a leash and was one of the only ones to stay outside of the crime scene tape, not charging in to investigate. which another patrolman on the scene that night found odd. He noted that usually with serious crimes, Officer Carter barged into the middle of whatever was going on, always wanting to be a part of the investigation. Around 8 a.m., they received word from Nashville that Candy Belt had died in the hospital where she had been airlifted. In the cold light of day, they processed the crime scene, but it didn't take very long. We are now a society weaned on shows like CSI and Law & Order, so this is kind of hard for us to understand. But the evidence shows that they collected a few stray hairs and bullet casings, dusted objects in the lobby and the jungle room where the murders occurred for fingerprints, and then pretty much called it a day. During Candy Belt's autopsy, semen was found in her vagina and anal cavity. As I've stated a couple of times, Tammy Papler enforced a strict condom rule. The cops surmised that Candy had to have been raped, not only because of Tammy's insistence that there was no way that Candy would have disobeyed the condom rule, but also because there was no note of any customer in that night's log. As the remaining three girls all agreed, it was a slow night and there were no customers. We'll find out later that one of them did spot a strange man, though he only hung around briefly without propositioning any of the workers. From the jump, the Christian County Sheriff's deputies liked Ed Carter for the murder. All of the evidence pointed to him, and though circumstantial, it was pretty damning. He still had a key. He had no verifiable alibi for the time of the murders, though he claimed he was with a mistress who happened to be a married soldier at Fort Campbell. He owned a .22 caliber handgun, which they determined was the same model used in the murders. His history of not only being a regular at New Life, but also a supposed employee certainly didn't help his case either. And most importantly, he was seen in the building by three witnesses within 30 minutes of the murders. This visit was suspicious because not only did he not engage with any of the women, he pretended to make a phone call and left abruptly. So the investigators figured he was scoping out the place, perhaps making sure that no men were in the building and that the Paplers hadn't decided to stop in. He had also failed a polygraph exam. And while the local and county cops wouldn't go on record at the time to say whether he passed or failed, they did ominously tell reporters that he was advised to retain counsel and asked to resign shortly thereafter. So you would think the case against Ed Carter had been neatly tied up with a bow. But this was Oak Grove, after all, notorious for corruption, located in a county with an equally bad track record. So though everyone knew Carter was a suspect, he was never arrested. Oak Grove police offered a $1,000 reward for information leading to the killer's arrest, and Tammy Papler added $5,000 to that number, but it didn't generate any leads. By November, there still hadn't been an arrest, but the Oak Grove Police Department had decided to shut Tammy down for good. They had the sewage tanks from New Life searched and found they were stuffed with condoms that had been flushed down toilets. Tammy Papler was charged with promoting prostitution, which she quickly pled down to a misdemeanor to avoid jail time, and then she closed down New Life Fitness and Massage for good. She then put all of her efforts into Cherry Video, her other adult business, and went on about her life. And before Ed Carter had even resigned from the police force, his wife had filed domestic abuse charges against him. They divorced, and he briefly moved to Nashville before settling back in Louisville, where he worked security at the airport. Whenever reporters questioned Oak Grove police or Christian County deputies about the status of the case, they were blown off with the old, "We're still waiting on lab results" excuse. Months went by, and soon 3 years had passed, and the case had gone completely cold. But there was a new police chief named Bobby Mace who was determined to turn the reputation of Oak Grove around. He would levy a new tax that would galvanize Tammy Papler into going public at an open city council meeting with salacious accusations. She wasn't really saying anything that people didn't already suspect, but this time she was offering proof, and also had a new ally on the city council. a woman named Patty Ballou, who herself was a former sex worker and had recently joined the council after turning her life around and marrying into one of the town's most powerful families. Despite her fear of losing her newfound status, she bravely stood up and backed Tammy's claims. And now, the tiny town of Oak Grove suddenly skyrocketed to the front page of national newspapers, and the legendary soap opera known as the Kentucky Bordello Murders was born. And that is where I'm going to leave you this week. Please join me next week for the long, twisting journey the scandalous case is going to take us on. I promise you won't be disappointed. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. This week, I'd like to recommend another podcast that I love and hope you might be interested in, called True Crime Storytime. My Aussie friends, Casey and Samantha, look into lesser-known cases from all over Australia. With their gorgeous accents, they take a deep dive into some heartbreaking cases with impeccable research and so much compassion. They are also fearless about taking what may be an unpopular stance with difficult cases, which I so admire. Please check them out. They're on Podbean, iTunes, and most podcatchers. Again, that is True Crime Storytime. I hope you'll give them a try. Thanks again for listening to Southern Fried True Crime. If you like the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I know that iTunes can make it harder than it should be, but I can't tell you how much it helps my show. Not only do ratings and reviews help others discover Southern Fried, but your lovely reviews often keep me going at 2 a.m. when I'm tired and feel like giving up. Also, by the time you're listening to this episode, I will have made the move to a network, and I could not have done that without your support. I am joining Blog Talk Radio and am very excited to be a part of their podcast family. You will now be able to access my episodes directly from their website, blogtalkradio.com/Southern Fried True Crime. I am also on Google Play and Stitcher and many other podcast platforms and apps like Overcast and Auto Radio. If you're interested in supporting the show, I am also now on Patreon, and I have stickers and magnets that I can't wait to send to you. I will also have a full merch store up for you soon with t-shirts and other goodies, which will also be rewards for different levels of donation on Patreon. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Southern Fried True Crime if you would like to connect with me there. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, y'all take care.